Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Has Earth Day actually changed the world? It's been 43 years since this brainchild of Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson first brought Americans together to express their concerns for the environment. And today, Earth Day is a truly global tradition with observances in nearly 200 countries. So what drove Nelson's passion and how have the environmental movement and its most ardent champions changed over more than four decades? Adam Rome teaches environmental history and environmental nonfiction at the University of Delaware. His new book is called The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation. Adam, welcome to Think.
Great. It's great to be on, Chris. Happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day to you, too. So what in 1970, what were the most significant environmental issues on people's minds?
Environmental problems were so everyday then, it's almost hard to imagine now. Almost every big city had incredibly polluted air, smog in Los Angeles, smoke almost everywhere. Rivers were unbelievably polluted. They could have wrecked cars. They could be bubbling up and discolored from effluent from factories or sewage. You never would want to swim or fish in them. People were worried about the loss of open space from sprawling metropolises, beginning to worry about whether there were too many people on the world, whether we were consuming too much and wasting too much. And a lot of these issues hit home in a way that really is amazing now, too. You could turn on your drinking water and find detergent foam coming out of it in many suburbs. So the issues had an immediacy that was really impressive.
You know, Adam, as awful as that all sounds, it is a nice reminder that we have made progress, even though it often feels like we're not getting anywhere.
We've made tremendous progress. I mean, most of the problems that people cared the most about in 1970, because of Earth Day, we've really successfully addressed. We've got much cleaner air. We've got much cleaner water. We've begun to do things about waste and sprawl and endangered species. Obviously, we've got new challenges now, problems that people were only beginning to glimpse back in 1970, like climate change. But we made impressive efforts as a result of Earth Day, not just individually, but as governments, as business, all since 1970.
So the primary non-professional environmental proponents back then were sort of a different mix than the people at the forefront of the movement today. Can you talk about that?
Well, there actually almost was no professional environmental group in 1970. I mean, there had been a variety of different kinds of concerns that it energized individuals, housewives, people in various professions, some government officials. Before 1970, you'd had in certain cities groups like Stamp Out Smog or to deal with air pollution, or you'd have people trying to protect a particular river or save open space. But they didn't come together, and there were in 1970, there was only one environmental organization that had the word nationally environmental in the title, The Environmental Defense Fund, which was only 3 years old and had no members. It was just a group of scientists and lawyers who were suing to deal with pesticides and other problems. There were hardly any people who were expert on environmental issues. One of the amazing things about Earth Day was that at least, by my count, 35,000 people spoke on Earth Day. And the vast majority of them had never spoken publicly about environmental issues before. So there really wasn't a true environmental movement. That phrase wasn't even used until just before Earth Day. There were some older organizations like the Sierra Club and the Audubon Society, National Wildlife Federation, that had been interested in parks and wilderness and game species. But there really wasn't anything like the modern institutionalized environmental movement with big national organizations with lobbyists and chapters all over the country and big staffs.
So tell us a little bit about Senator Gaylord Nelson and what motivated his commitment to the environment.
I think he's an amazing story, both of persistence and really a kind of visionary wisdom. He was born in a real small town in Wisconsin that allowed him to do anything outdoors that he wanted. He grew up taking for granted the pleasures of the outdoors. And even though he didn't hunt or fish, He always thought that was really important. And when he became governor in 1959, he was worried that the sprawl of Chicago and the sprawl of Milwaukee would take away those kind of opportunities from kids of the next generation. So he began to work on open space. He also began to glimpse the extent of the problem of water pollution, especially in the Great Lakes. And then when he was elected to the Senate in 1963, he decided that was the most important issue facing the country. And he spent the whole of the 60s trying in one way or another and failing again and again to get environment to be a national priority. Soon after he was elected, he convinced President John Kennedy to take a conservation tour of the country. But that was really a bust. The president by himself couldn't really make a movement. You couldn't have a top-down movement. The media coverage wasn't enough. There just weren't the crowds, the ordinary people involved. And then he tried in Congress to introduce legislation to deal with the big problems, the problems of pesticides, which people had learned about from Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, or water pollution. And he just couldn't get anyone to do anything in Congress. And so finally, in 1969, after one of the most shocking environmental disasters of the decade, the Santa Barbara oil spill, he was flying back to Washington having seen the damage for the first time, and he read about a tactic that the anti-Vietnam War movement had used, teach-ins outside the classroom, seminars that were politicized, and thought, yes, maybe young people could do what Congress couldn't, what the president couldn't. Maybe they could change the country. And so in September 69, he said he was going to organize a national environmental teach-in in spring 1970, and that became Earth Day.
So tell us a little bit more about teach-ins. I mean, the term sounds sort of quaint to us today, but they were really a significant cultural and political tool in the late 60s.
Yeah, in fact, the term even sounded a little quaint to some of the younger people that Gaylor Nelson hired to help him coordinate Earth Day. They thought that teach-ins were kind of passe as a protest technique, but they had been very powerful. They really allowed people who were against the war to talk to people who were for it and argue about it and get to the root causes of what might be doable or not doable in Vietnam. And people came out of those teach-ins, in many cases, energized to do more. And that's what Nelson saw, that the teach-in was an incredible transformative educational process, and he was hoping Earth Day would be something similar. And it turned out to be that times a million more than what he expected, I think.
What had changed between 1963, when he convinced the president to take this national conservation tour, and 1969, 1970, that made the country ready for something like Earth Day?
That's a great question. People often focus on mounting highly visible disasters, so the Santa Barbara oil spill in 1969, the Cuyahoga River caught fire outside in Cleveland, and you know, the idea that water could catch on fire was just mind-boggling to people. Actually, the Cuyahoga had caught on fire before many times, and people in Cleveland just took it for granted that that was part of what it meant to live in a polluted city. So part of what changed wasn't just that the issues themselves were becoming more visible. I think the biggest change was the growing will to do something, and the sense that it was an incredibly prosperous time for the United States. People felt we were rich enough to do anything, including tackle problems that we had long thought we had to just put up with. And I think also there was a tremendous faith then, which we've lost to some extent, that government could really solve problems, that people trusted bureaucrats. That wasn't a nasty word. Government officials really knew a lot about some of these issues, and not just at the federal level. People trusted their state governments. And so I think it really, there was just the need for a spark. People knew these were problems. They hadn't really seen that they could do something about them. And the other thing that I think was new with Earth Day was that people had treated these problems as separate things. They hadn't really connected all the dots. They hadn't suddenly said, wait a minute, we have water pollution, we have air pollution, we have pesticides killing wildlife and maybe people. We've got sprawl, we've got trash, we've got all these problems. We have an environmental crisis, and that was a phrase that people started to use. Nelson used it himself at the end of the decade, the sense that these problems were mounting, that there were far more of them than people had realized, and most importantly, that maybe if we tried, we really could do something about them.
Were issues, Adam, of environmental stewardship and conservation less partisan in nature, or seen as less partisan in nature back then than they are today?
Absolutely, and it's really stunning to me how far we've come from that, how bitterly divided and polarized the environmental issues have become. Because back in 1969-70, Nelson reached out to a Republican to help co-sponsor Earth Day. He got Senator Pete McCloskey of California, and conservative politicians spoke on Earth Day. Barry Goldwater, who had been the torchbearer of the far right in 1964 in the presidential campaign, he spoke at Adelphi University in New York and was really quite passionate about the importance of young people doing things. He wrote a book later that year, The Conscience of a Majority, devoted a whole chapter to saving the Earth. So the environmental cause and Earth Day were both bigger than politics. People on all parts of the ideological spectrum recognized that there were serious issues that had to be addressed. They didn't always agree about how to address them, but there was no real doubt among the vast, vast majority of Americans that these were serious. A few conservatives thought Earth Day was a communist plot, and a few people on the far left thought that it was an effort to divert attention from more pressing problems of economic injustice and the war in Vietnam. Hmm. But the vast majority of Americans recognized that we had to do something. We had serious problems, and we had to address them somehow.
So Nelson had this great idea. He had a passion for environmental issues, but obviously he's a sitting senator. He can't do this all himself. How did he choose the team of people he wanted to help facilitate the first Earth Day?
I think this is part of the amazing nature of Earth Day. That the idea that a sitting senator, as you say, a 50-year-old balding figure of the establishment could set in motion what became the greatest demonstration in American history. Millions and millions of people, at the time people estimated 20 million, which would have been one out of nine Americans, took part in thousands and thousands of events, virtually every college, virtually every K-12 school, and many, many communities. It's just mind-boggling that a senator would do that. And at first he thought his own staff could manage to coordinate Earth Day, but they were just deluged with inquiries about what to do and how to do it. And so he decided to hire a group of young activists, and they eventually formed their own group after Earth Day that stayed in business called Environmental Action. And they were all 20-somethings. Only one of them had really done anything with environmental issues before, but they had been involved in the anti-Vietnam cause. They had been involved in the civil rights issue. One had been a volunteer trying to help elect Robert Kennedy president in 1968. And they came from all over the country. One was from New Mexico and had been a leader on campus at the University of New Mexico in creating Chicano studies and standing up for Chicano employees of the university. They all saw this as an opportunity. They were more radical in some ways than Nelson to try to move the country toward a more progressive agenda. And he hired first a couple from Harvard, who were doing joint graduate degrees and undergraduate degrees, mostly in law schools, although one was in medical school. Dennis Hayes is the best known. Mm-hmm. Then they hired other people to ultimately help coordinate events in the South and the West and the Midwest, everywhere.
Adam Rome is with us. He teaches environmental history and environmental nonfiction at the University of Delaware. We're talking about his new book, The Genius of Earth Day, how a 1970 teach-in unexpectedly made the first green generation. Join the conversation now at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Adam Rome. He teaches environmental history and environmental nonfiction at the University of Delaware, and he's the author of a new book called The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation. If you've got a question, maybe you remember the first Earth Day and want to share a story with us, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. You know, it's funny, Adam, thinking about the remarkable attention that the first Earth Day received, and obviously Gaylord Nelson was at the heart of this idea. These days, we would assume that someone like that had presidential aspirations and that this was just sort of being done as a way to springboard. But it doesn't look like Nelson was interested in running for president.
People have always wondered about that. You know, he never did run for anything else. He remained senator until 1980, when he lost in the Reagan landslide of 1980. But I think you're right. I think we're so used to politicians being all about themselves and their own ambitions that Gaylord Nelson really stands out as someone. You just can't explain this any other way except that he cared really deeply about this issue and he wanted to do something about it. And he figured out a way. I think this was his genius. He figured out a way to get thousands and thousands of other people engaged, to allow them to make Earth Day their own, to own it, so that it wasn't just his thing. He wasn't the helicopter parent. He didn't hover over this and try to manage everything. He let the local Earth Day organizers decide for themselves what kind of event it would be. And that, too, is remarkably selfless and amazing.
Yeah, and it certainly made sense with regard to the extent to which people engaged with all these activities. So if your community had a really problematic waterway and 100 miles south there was a community that was dealing with air pollution, each one could sort of design Earth Day events to reflect what their concerns were.
Absolutely. You know, so Birmingham, Alabama, a place that, you know, at the time was notorious because it had been a scene of civil rights strife, had unbelievably polluted air. There was a U.S. steel factory there. It had among the worst air of any city in the country. And they had a whole week, Right to Live week, that culminated in Earth Day, and that really, really drew attention to the problem. You know, across the country, Fairbanks, Alaska, the big issue there was what was going to become the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Should it be built? What would the cost be? Was there a better way to build it? So people could design their own Earth Days. And so some of them were fun. Some of them were deadly serious. Many of them really did last a whole week, and they tried to engage the whole community in all kinds of ways. And the organizing effort often took months. People started hearing about this in late fall 1969. By January, it was clear that Earth Day was going to become much bigger than Nelson thought. And all over the country, people started planning for it. And it was just one person. Sometimes it was hundreds of people that put together these Earth Day programs, and putting them together was transformative for many. People looked back at it and said, you know, they realized they could do something, that it was tremendously empowering to see Earth Day happen after they had spent months planning it and getting the big crowds and the interesting, you know, soul-searching discussions.
How was April 22nd chosen as the date?
Nelson got a lot of trouble for that date. At first, he was envisioning that Earth Day would only be something that colleges would celebrate. He really didn't expect that K-12 schools would get involved or that communities would have their own celebrations apart from colleges. So he just wanted a date that was after spring break but before finals, where the weather would be decent in north and south, and it was a Wednesday. He didn't want college students to have to be distracted by what they were going to do for the weekend or hungover from what they had done on the weekend before. So a Wednesday was an odd choice, you know, for adults. It made it much harder for adults to celebrate Earth Day. But it turned out to be great. But the coincidence that he didn't foresee that got him into trouble was it was the 100th anniversary of Vladimir Lenin's birth. And so people who were already predisposed to see it as a radical event said, "Wow, oh my God, Lenin's birthday. This is definitely a communist plot." So he was a funny guy. He said, you know, on any given day, millions and millions of people are born who are bad. you know, but I didn't think about Lenin. I was thinking about my Aunt Tilly. It was her birthday, and it was St. Francis Assisi's birthday, and he mentioned one or two other people. And so that's how it was chosen.
And I love this. Congress gave itself the day off, and a huge percentage of lawmakers went back to their districts and participated in these events.
Two-thirds of Congress spoke somewhere, and many spoke to multiple places. Kind of interesting. There wasn't anything like the information technology that we take for granted. So some senators, like I know one in Kansas, three different places wanted him to speak. He couldn't be in three places at once. So they jerry-rigged some kind of system that allowed him to talk by phone to these three different campuses. But people everywhere, it wasn't just the federal government. Earth Day really, really impressed politicians. Several governors on that day created new state environmental protection agencies. Two legislatures signed, approved environmental bills of rights for their state. The media also gave unprecedented coverage to environmental issues. The Today Show, I'm still blown away by this, devoted its entire week, 10 hours, 2 hours every day, to the environment. It was basically a televised teach-in, and they had incredible guests and really interesting discussion. And Hugh Downs started it with this unbelievably powerful, you know, put down your toast and your orange juice, we've got some serious things to talk about, introduction. So the media got onto it. Politicians realized that there was a groundswell of interest in this far more than they'd ever thought. And that was amazing.
And then within like 3 years, Congress passed the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Endangered Species Act.
Right. And the president at the end of the year, a Republican president, Richard Nixon, created the Environmental Protection Agency. Historians talk about this as the beginning of the environmental decade. We had one piece of major national legislation after another. We had Safe Drinking Water Acts. We had acts to deal with hazardous waste as well as ordinary garbage. And that's the first time. We didn't have any powerful, action-compelling statutes on environmental issues before 1970. But the thing that amazed me that I didn't know, I don't think really anyone knew before I started to look into this, was how many other ways Earth Day institutionalized environmental concern. Before Earth Day, there were only literally a handful, three or four people working for newspapers who wrote primarily about environmental issues, and most of those had only been doing it for a few months. The New York Times only created an environmental beat in 1969. And none of the national television networks had environmental reporters. Within 4 or 5 months of Earth Day, over 100 newspapers, not just big ones, in communities where this newspaper only had circulation of 7,500, had environmental reporters. It's just astonishing how quickly that beat caught on. Environmental studies and programs, environmental education was also just beginning at that time and explodes after Earth Day. Communities create ecology centers, places where you could go to learn more, and those ecology centers were the first in places in many communities to have recycling programs, something that we take for granted now. There wasn't any recycling in any organized way. Even if you wanted to, it was almost impossible to recycle stuff. After Earth Day, that takes hold. Publishers bring out hundreds and hundreds of eco-books. Someone at the Library of Congress wrote a year later that more books had been published about environmental issues since Earth Day than ever before in American history, which is an exaggeration, but there really were an incredible number of books, and often by very, very young authors, people who had become expert in the course of organizing Earth Day events, and because there were so few other experts, they could write books that became big sellers.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Oh, thanks. You know, the hippies, when they first became an item in America, were kind of denigrated. But I think people realized after a while that they were leading some pretty interesting and creative lives. And part of it was that we were paying attention to the earth. We're paying attention to the Mother Earth that we were growing up with. And the Whole Earth Catalog, which was a fantastic creative piece of work, was probably one of the more important elements of that creativity that, I guarantee you, edified the environmental movement that started the move towards Earth Day. And I think that all of the people in government were definitely involved and on board with it until the Republican Party just became racially divided, I mean, a racist, and divided themselves off from the rest of the country and became reactionary in all respects.
Well, let's get a comment. And Jim, I don't know that it's fair to characterize the Republican Party as racist, but maybe, Adam, you can speak to that sort of spirit of the counterculture movement and how it contributed to Earth Day.
Yeah, Chris, I think Jim is right. The counterculture, which had been growing in the late 60s, really was the first group of people to start thinking about how their own lifestyle affected their relationship to the Earth. And Earth Day really makes that countercultural question more mainstream. There had been no books before 1970 that were guides to ecological living. And after Earth Day, a dozen of them come out almost instantly. And all of a sudden, ordinary people, not just people who were living in communes out in the wild or in hippie neighborhoods and cities, begin to ask themselves the same question. You know, where's my garbage going? Is there any way I can make less garbage? Is there a better way to get from place to place besides taking the car? What else can I do to reduce my environmental footprint? People in the counterculture had been thinking about that for several years, and they were definitely part of this building concern that culminates in Earth Day. But after Earth Day, that becomes something that ordinary people are also thinking about, and publishers recognize it as well.
So you mentioned earlier that the Environmental Defense Fund was still a new organization, 2 or 3 years old, at the time of the first Earth Day. Can you talk about its most significant early goals?
It got started challenging the use of DDT in suburban Long Island, and then it went on to press for statewide bans on the use of DDT in Michigan and Wisconsin. And then by the end of the decade, it had also expanded to air pollution. The most famous EDF lawyer was a guy named Victor Yannicone. I think I can say over the radio that his slogan, and this got him national attention. He was in Playboy. He was in Sports Illustrated. He was a big speaker on Earth Day itself, was "Sue the Bastards." And that included businesses. It also included government agencies who were misusing pesticides, polluting the air and the water. He was trying to establish that you had a right to a clean environment. And environmental law was barely a profession then, or a subgroup of the profession. He was a real pioneer. And he was more radical than many other environmental lawyers. People thought he was kind of on the extreme, but he appreciated that.
So the environmental law was less well established at that point, and environmental lobbyists were less established, as were, it seems, industrial lobbyists working in the other direction.
Absolutely. So the environmental groups didn't have lobbies because the tax code at the time, and this wasn't changed until the mid-70s, you'd lose your tax-exempt status if you lobbied. So, and that had happened to the Sierra Club briefly when they attacked a dam. They lost their tax-exempt status. So the older conservation organizations weren't willing to risk that. But some new organizations, including this group started by the 20-somethings that Nelson hired, Environmental Action, decided they wanted to enter politics. They were going to lobby. They were going to endorse candidates and work against candidates. Environmental Action in 1970 picked its Dirty Dozen incumbents, people that they thought had particularly egregious records on the environment and were vulnerable. And they beat 7 out of 12 of them. And that got national attention, a new force in politics. But I think your question is great, Chris, because the business folks were caught off guard. They didn't really expect this explosion of interest. Very few business leaders were prepared to talk on Earth Day itself. Very few businesses really had a strategy yet for how to address this mounting concern. Over time, they became more sophisticated and also more alarmed. They realized that some of these seemingly overwhelmingly popular acts like the Clean Air Act had far more implications than was first apparent. That they worried that in heavily polluted cities, the EPA might not allow there to be new businesses until pollution was brought down to a level that was acceptable. So they begin by the later 70s to think of new ways to try to counter the pressure to change. Eventually, some of them get with the program and realize that it would be better if they tried really hard to reduce pollution. They might even make more money doing it. But many others have become more aggressive in trying to cast doubt on the science or to argue that it would cost too much or in other ways defuse the popular demand for more environmental protection.
And, of course, EDF and some similar organizations have been criticized in recent years for deciding to try, when possible, to work with major industry rather than against it.
Yeah, EDF is an amazing story that way because it started out with the Sue the Bastard spirit, and then in the 80s remade itself. It became the first of the major national environmental organizations, number one, to try to create partnerships with business, win-win partnerships with business, but also to look for market solutions, ways in which without regulation or with minimal regulation, you could address environmental problems. I think that's one of the big differences since 1970 is that there are a lot more businesses now that are trying to become greener. And among my students, I have a lot of students who they're not Sierra Club members. They don't think of themselves as tree huggers, but they want to invent industrial processes or industrial products that are greener and find alternative ways of doing business that would have less environmental impact. And back then, business was pretty much the enemy in 1970. The car was the biggest enemy, but business in general got a lot of abuse. As polluters. A few Earth Day people, a few Earth Day organizers gave awards to businesses that were doing good. Many others had halls of shame or other things to try to draw attention to those businesses that were doing poorly.
Adam Rome is with us. His new book is The Genius of Earth Day. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Adam Rome. He teaches environmental history and environmental nonfiction at the University of Delaware. His new book is called The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or calling 1-800-933-5372. Adam, you told us earlier that even Gaylord Nelson couldn't have dreamed that the first Earth Day would be as widespread, as impactful as it was. Were there always plans to make this an event that would be repeated at intervals over time?
No. Actually, Gaylord Nelson originally thought it would just be a one-time deal. And then because it was so unbelievably successful, he thought that there ought to be an annual event afterward that would allow the media, politicians, teachers, students, to essentially have a kind of report card. How much had we done? How much progress had we made in dealing with these problems? I think he realized that the problems were so many and so complicated, we weren't going to solve them all with just a few magic bullets. They were going to take time. And in some cases, they were just ongoing. You know, they involved managing a problem rather than anything you could do to eliminate it. So he foresaw that we would have a need to have an annual event where we could look back on the year before. And that's pretty much what Earth Day's become, especially for the media. But I think also this is true in schools, that people look at the calendar, they say April 22nd is coming up. You know, what have we done for the Earth lately? And that's what he hoped would happen.
What do we know about the tendency to engage beyond Earth Day itself when you compare people who actually go and attend a rally somewhere with people who maybe look things up online and sign a petition, that sort of thing?
I think one of the most interesting parts of Earth Day to me is the whole thing was before there was any social media. I mean, there weren't even Xerox machines, really. people were mimeographing stuff. They had Rolodexes. They had no instant communication. So everything took longer. And I think that was part of the power of the event, that people, just because the technology was so rudimentary of communicating, they did a lot face-to-face. They did a lot in time-consuming ways, and that allowed their thinking to really sink in. They gave them a chance to reflect. And a lot of people became involved in Earth Day who had really no long-time interest in environmental issues. They didn't particularly love nature. They just saw this as a do-gooder thing. They saw this as a civic problem that they could address. And then they came to think it was more important, and they ended up, in many cases, devoting their life to it or many years to it. And so the level of commitment might have started very low, not much more than the commitment of someone who just signs a check or signs a petition. But the process of organizing Earth Day and for many people also going to Earth Day, and again, many Earth Day events were not just one day, they were a week long, that intensified the commitment of many people and led them to, in all kinds of really interesting entrepreneurial ways, create environmental careers, because there really were no career paths then for people interested in these issues. And I think that's missing now. A lot of the big environmental organizations don't really actively try to nurture the leadership skills or the commitment of their members, and they can learn a lesson, I think, from Earth Day.
Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. Steve writes, would I be naive to think with all the positive advancements we've made regarding the environment that our future will be even cleaner?
Well, I think we're at another critical moment. We're facing issues, climate change is most obvious, that are very complicated. They're going to require all kinds of people in all kinds of professions all over the world to do something if we're going to avoid some really serious problems down the road. And I hope we will address them in the same way that in 1970 people really made a serious effort to deal with the problems that were most prominent then, and they succeeded, at least in the U.S. Some places elsewhere, we did outsource some of our pollution. We now buy a lot of stuff that's made elsewhere in a heavily polluting way. We don't see the pollution. Our air is better. Our water is better. That's another challenge, too, for the next generation. I hope eventually we will get a handle on these problems, but they are grave, and I hope we can respond in the same way people did in 1970.
You know, that's an interesting point about invisible pollution, because, I mean, I grew up in the 70s, and I remember, you know, you'd see places where there was trash strewn around, and it was pretty clear what needed to be done, whereas now you can't just necessarily look out at the world and know exactly what the problems are.
I think that's true, and it makes it much harder, because people then really, you know, they had a visceral disgust for some of the pollution that they saw, some of the waste piling up. And it's much harder to see some of the challenges we face now. Although, even in the last decade, climate change has become less something that is abstract and that you have to rely on scientific testimony. There are more ways in which you can see it. You know, if you garden, you may be seeing some new insects, as well as, you know, things blooming at different times. You may be seeing new animals. Obviously, the big storms. But we're still not to the point that we were at in 1970 where almost anyone could say, oh, my God, you know, we've been putting up with this for too long. If we don't do something soon, we might face really, you know, catastrophe. We're not there yet.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Linda on the line in Murphy. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I was at the first Earth Day here at the Tarrant County Junior College in South Campus, Fort Worth, and it literally changed my life.
Really? How did that happen?
Well, I was taking some ecology classes, and I was already interested, and we had some professors come down from Boulder, Colorado, which was really on the cutting edge of this at the time, and we had an all-day seminar, and I remember a professor had said, he said, if you drove a muscle car, it was like you had a sign around your neck saying you were an irresponsible citizen. And so I was so horrified because I was driving a big Thunderbird at that time. I went home and sold my car, bought a small Japanese car, and I also joined zero population growth. That was to limit your children to two, just a replacement of yourself and your spouse. So I got a degree in environmental science and a master's, and I'm still involved with 350.org, which is right now they're trying to stop the Keystone Pipeline from coming through. So it's with me every day.
Well, Linda, thank you so much for that call. Adam, I would imagine you've heard from a lot of people like Linda as you've been researching this book.
Well, Linda just made my day. That's a great story. But you're right. I ended up, one of the marvels of modern technology is I was able to track down a lot of people who organized Earth Day events or who went to them and later wrote something that indicated it changed their life, and I interviewed them. And those stories were incredibly inspiring. I was just amazed at the things that people did as a result of Earth Day all over the country. Linda's story reminds me of someone I write about at the very end of the book. I end the book with four people whose lives were changed. One of them, Buck Robinson, was from a really well-to-do family in Chicago, had a law degree and a business degree, but he too was shocked on Earth Day into rethinking his whole life. He sold all of his possessions. He bought a motorcycle. He took a road trip for a while, and at the end of it, he decided he was going to be an eco-entrepreneur. He opened a bookstore that specialized in environmental stuff. It became a foundation, essentially. He gave away the profits to local students wanting to go study environmental things in college and to local groups working on environmental problems, and then went on to start an alternative energy store in an abandoned gas station. I love the symbolism of that, a place where you could buy solar stuff and windmills and wood-burning stoves. That got national attention. And so, again and again, people had that same experience, like Linda or like Buck Robinson, of Earth Day awakening something in them that then really led to fundamentally a new way of doing things and real commitment.
And Robinson was among the first Americans to drive a Prius.
Yes. And in fact, he was the first in New Hampshire, where he lived, to have a Prius. And his license plate was just, 48 plus MPG, and then just before he ended up dying, as it turned out, he got the second generation Prius, which got even better mileage, so he changed his license plate to reflect that, and was really very proud of having been one of the first people at the local level to try to encourage a more energy efficient economy.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Chapman, calling from Dallas. Hi, Chapman.
Hi. I was a delegate for the 16th UNESCO Conference on Man and the Environment in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1976, I'm a painter, came up with the idea that I can make my paintings by planting them.
Hmm.
Started at DFW Airport, then a temporary one in relationship to retrospective exhibit of my paintings at the Museum of Natural History. They invited me to Chicago, where we did a wildflower works of the native flowers from there. Two ellipses, 150 by 310 feet each at the top of Grant Park, blooming not just a few flowers in the spring. That doesn't save any water. We arranged, because I had the best scientist, Dr. Tom Allen, working with me, we arranged for the flowers to blossom all the way through the season. No water, no insecticides, and no fertilizers. And we had it there for 20 years.
Wow, what a great symbol of the things we can do if we pay attention and consult science and landscape accordingly.
Absolutely. And again, Earth Day, because Nelson left it up to individuals to decide what to do, people didn't have to think about legislation, even though that was what he was most interested in. They could think about using the arts to inspire people, to stretch their imaginations. And lots of people came out of Earth Day with that creativity and did amazing stuff. So that's a great story, Chapman.
I think we have time briefly for one more call. Let's go to Rhonda in Murphy. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi. Yes. Well, I garden on my driveway. I'm an excellent driveway gardener, and that's how I contribute to Earth Day. But my question or comment is about how do cities justify on a local level that you can drive down, for instance, maybe Preston Road here in the Dallas area, major thoroughfare, and as long as you're going north and south, it looks, you know, very, very pretty. But if you take some of the side roads, there's trash piling up, you know, the lawns aren't manicured, the sanitation is just, you know, so there's such a striking difference. And I just wonder, how do cities justify that when, you know, communities are existing in the same county, the same city, paying the same taxes, but the idea of keeping the earth safe, even just from picking up the trash as a civic responsibility of, you know, what our tax dollars go for, how does that contribute to the way we should all be paying attention to not just April 22nd, but, you know, every single day?
Well, do you have any thoughts on that, Adam?
Well, obviously, one thing is people have to say that they care about that. And I think it's important, you know, as you're suggesting, that environmental issues aren't just about grave threats to our personal health or to the health of other creatures. They're also about aesthetics. We all really like it, love it, if we can be in beautiful surroundings. And that's always been something that people have, who have been interested in environmental issues, have argued, that that matters too. It's not just about whether you're going to be poisoned by DDT. You're going to be happier, your kids are going to be happier, you're going to feel better about your community if it's an attractive place, if it's a place that shows that people want to have some kind of harmonious relationship to the environment. But I think ordinary citizens have to keep reminding their elected officials that they care about that and also that they're willing to pay for it.
Were you surprised to discover that the history of Earth Day had not been comprehensively documented before you took on this project?
I was. I myself had really never, I'd lectured about Earth Day, but it never really occurred to me that it was a great story waiting to be told, and that it had all these profound long-term consequences until I began to look into it. At first, I just wanted to tell a good story, but I ended up realizing it was a more amazing story, more inspiring story than I ever could have imagined. I think partly why it didn't get told before, the national media covered it at the time as though it was just a big 60s demonstration. It was just street theater. The most famous image was a young kid wearing a gas mask trying to smell the blossom of a tree, which was really symbolic. But it turned out that Earth Day was much more than symbolism. That's what people had missed before. And I think that they missed it because the national media played this up as a demonstration. They didn't see some of the longer consequences. They didn't imagine all the ways in which Earth Day helped to institutionalize environmental concern. So I was really amazed when I discovered that. And the book took me a lot longer to write than I thought. But it kept me inspired the whole time.
Adam Rome's new book is called The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation. Adam, great conversation. Thank you so much for being with us.
That was my pleasure, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.